What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
America Trends, back wherever you are, and we're so glad that you're continuing to listen to our podcasts. John Kropsik, Larry Rifkin, putting care into every one of them. And John, we like to ask the big questions. We like to look over the horizon to see what are we missing about the political and social challenges that we face as a society. And I will tell you that one of the things that we were so focused on for such a long period of time was about the ISIS threat. Was it just about to come into America in a major way?
Well, supposedly now the news is that we've knocked ISIS down and...
Well, I don't know that that's quite true. I mean, at least according to the person we're going to be speaking with in just a moment, the fact is that they've changed their tactics a lot, and we haven't. I mean, we're still out there at times trying to kill the number two or number three of Al-Qaeda or ISIS, and yet they keep popping back up no matter. I don't want to be number two or three in one of those terrorist organizations.
Well, I really think it's a no-win situation for us over there. I think, you know, change has got to come over there, and I think there's a lot of changes being made in Saudi Arabia and places, slowly but surely, but we are terrible nation builders, and I believe it's time for us to really be out of the Middle East. And
well, don't forget, the logic was, let's get over there so the threat doesn't come here. At the same time that we say that, I know the president is thinking of pulling back a lot of troops out of Afghanistan and Syria, though he wants to keep his eye on Iran through Iraq. But while he says that, he also says that at the same time, all these terrorists are streaming across the southern border. Now, I've heard this for about, I don't know, 10, 15 years. They must be the most patient lot of terrorists.
Well, you know, we got a problem with immigration here. That's a whole other thing.
Yeah, but I'm saying they're all lying in wait, or they got married, they have families, and they have a job at Walmart now. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I don't know. You're right. It used to be they're going to sneak the bomb across and blow up. I heard that.
Well, just recently, the president posted something on Twitter with prayer rugs at the border. Look, I don't know, but I'm tired of people trying to scare us to death. I really am.
No, me too.
I want to know the truth. And we don't really understand now how these terror groups have changed their strategies and tactics, John. We just get this whatever polemic one side or the other wants to, pose. But I think we've got somebody today who's going to really tell us a lot about the changes that are going on amidst these organizations. And it's still a threat. Don't get me wrong. But it may be a different kind of threat. But have we really awoken to the changes? I don't know. We'll find out today with Catherine Zimmerman from the American Enterprise Institute here on America Trends. Well, there's a new report out from the American Enterprise Institute, and it talks about the critical threat of Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other groups, and the fact that they have exploited weaknesses in the U.S. counterterrorism strategy. With us is Catherine Zimmerman, a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And Catherine, many of us may have been lulled into complacency lately because the number of attacks outside of the Middle East have seemingly shrunk over the recent period. Am I imagining this, or is that real?
You're certainly not imagining it. The number of terrorist attacks have gone down, and even in Europe, they're asking the same questions of, haven't we defeated these groups, and aren't we safe now? But the problem is, we're measuring by attacks, and when we're not measuring by attacks, then we start measuring by how many square kilometers, do these groups control? And none of these groups define their success by how many terrorist attacks they can conduct or how many kilometers of land they control.
But at a certain point, I think many of us saw this caliphate developing, and ISIS was telling us that they were going to rebuild the caliphate, and they did assume territory, and they've lost it subsequently. So were we misled, or did we misunderstand the message that they were sending to us?
We certainly understood the message well, and the Islamic State's control of terrain was very, very important to its success. To be able to say that it had a caliphate, to show that it had a caliphate, was incredibly important, especially in 2014, 2015, and into 2016. But all of that began to change, and the problem is we didn't recognize that it was changing. The Islamic State is no longer emphasizing its control of terrain, and beyond that, Al-Qaeda has even moved beyond direct control of terrain to trying to have other groups lead the governance, because it knows that once it calls something a caliphate or an emirate, the United States perks up, and it's basically a flare for the U.S. to do something.
So you tell us that U.S. strategies to eradicate the movement and reduce the threat rely on military action against specific organizations and individuals. And Catherine, I cannot forget how just about every other week when I was doing a radio program, I would read about the number two of Al-Qaeda in Iraq has been taken out. And then the next number two, and the next number two. And I didn't know whether that was progress or not. So where are we misleading ourselves here?
It's not just with the number two of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or even the number three of Al-Qaeda writ large, which apparently is the most dangerous position to hold since we've killed him most rapidly over the years. But the real problem is that we're trying to define our enemy by a specific group that we can target militarily, and whether that's just Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda in Yemen or Al-Qaeda in Syria or the Islamic State, we're trying to define just a part of the movement of which these groups are just a component of. And as we start to do that, it means that we've left behind the bulk of supporters. And it's from these supporters that we see groups like the Islamic State come back up and resurge. And this is the point that I'm trying to make. It's not that we need to have a bigger military fight. It's that the military fight we're fighting is only against a part of the group, and it's not going to be sufficient.
Well, you tell us that they have embedded in local communities, taken on new identities, and that their focus has always been, though we misunderstand this, we think that they really want to come and get us, is to really control the dynamic in their own country or countries or the Middle East at large.
That's right. They are really focused on getting what they believe to be Muslims to follow their form of Islam. And the terrorist attacks that we perceive here at home that have certainly threatened our way of life at times, those are just a tactic to get the United States to withdraw. And so the question that I'm raising is, you know, if we define these groups to be illiberal and problematic, and they're having success on the ground where they want to have success, that should be a problem for us.
You say that these groups have hidden their true nature by hiding their ties to global jihadi groups such as Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, and by rebranding and reorganizing on the ground. Give us an example of where that's taking place. I think many of us have had our eyes on what's happened in Syria, though it's been rather quiet in the news lately, and of course in Iraq. But to give us a sense of what is going on and how this is actually taking place.
Syria is the most obvious example of where Al-Qaeda has hidden its hand. And I've been asked many times, why don't I hear about Al-Qaeda in Syria? Why aren't the experts talking about this? And my response is because the experts are having an expert disagreement over who is Al-Qaeda and who is not in Syria. The experts agree that there is a massive Salafi jihadi threat in northwest Syria. But we're trying to define precisely who is Al-Qaeda because that defines who we end up targeting. So when we talk about Al-Qaeda in Syria, we're talking about all of these groups, and they've gone through so many name changes that, frankly, the public and our policymakers have problems keeping up with it. But it's happened elsewhere, too. You can look at Mali, and, you know, you can look at the arguments over whether the group that took over Timbuktu was part of Al-Qaeda or not. Turns out it was, but it didn't use the Al-Qaeda name for a long time.
What about the Taliban in Afghanistan? They've always had more of a focus on local issues, if you will, and we're told that they're probably as strong, if not stronger, than they've been in a long time in Afghanistan itself. Is that a good example of a group that, whatever you want to call them, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda related, whatever, that this is really their focus ultimately to take control of the government of Afghanistan?
The Taliban is an excellent example, and the Afghanistan in the 1990s is what Al-Qaeda is trying to recreate elsewhere. And the reason why it's a problem is not because it should matter to the United States how the rest of the world is governed, though I can argue that we actually should care, but because the Taliban specifically gave refuge and safe haven to the components of Al-Qaeda that then planned the 9/11 attacks, because there was no firebreak behind the Taliban's idea of what just governance looks like and what they need to do for to be a good Muslim, and the vision, the radical vision that Osama bin Laden and others espoused within Al-Qaeda.
So are we still looking at it as we can cut off the head of the snake and we can do away with some of these groups once we have decapitated the leader or what have you, that in fact things will resolve in our favor? Is that what we're still trying to do? What's our strategy?
The strategy hasn't changed that much over the past decade, or two decades even, because it's so hard. And I think that there's now a disconnect between how we are seeing the problem and how people are understanding the problem and then what we're actually doing about it. So when you talk to practitioners, they very much understand. So special operations personnel, they understand that what they're doing yields short-term results. But they're good at it, it's their job, and it's effective. So that's what we keep doing. And then we have Congress understanding that we're going to have to keep doing this fight until we find another answer. But the answer is to start breaking the connection that these groups have made with local populations. And that's much more complicated than anyone wants to take on. And so rather than taking it on, we're just falling back on what's easy and what we have already in the works in U.S. policy and our counterterrorism infrastructure that is, frankly, on autopilot at times.
Well, Anne Speckhard, who runs the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism, has just published a report, and it says, historically speaking, compelling narratives and messages have always served as a crucial means for violent extremist groups to attract followers to their cause. In this regard, terrorist groups like ISIS have managed to attract thousands of fighters to the conflict zones in Iraq and Syria. We've always been told that the United States has been terrible in terms of our messaging to the Arab world, and that that is still a weakness of ours. Do you agree?
It's certainly a weakness of ours, but I actually would push back on whether the messaging is the most important part of this. I think a lot of the problem is that the narrative that we heard coming out of Syria, for example, was actually true. The United States was not standing up for the people that the Assad regime was brutally murdering, and you know, the U.S. would have the rhetoric of saying that it was unacceptable, but would not hold the regime accountable. And I think that the people on the ground looked for somebody or an organization that would stand up for them, and the organization on the ground happened to be Al-Qaeda.
You say that the current strategic approach to defeating Al-Qaeda remains kind of the way it was after 9/11. We've got the armed forces, they've got a mix of drone strikes, air and missile attacks, special forces raids, and military operations to clear various terrain. What's wrong with that? I mean, what should we supplant that with?
If only that answer were that easy. I think that, you know, as we're looking at what we need to be doing, it's taking our mind away from a counterterrorism paradigm, because counterterrorism, at the end of the day, is trying to prevent an attack here in the homeland or against U.S. personnel. If we're only trying to do that, then what we have in place is completely sufficient. The challenge that I see is that we're going to continue to face these threats until we actually defeat the organizations and the movement from which they come. And we're not going to be able to do that with the military alone. So it's going to be taking a much more political and diplomatic approach and understanding that the local context, so the Syrian civil war, the Yemeni civil war, what's happening inside of Libya, in Mali, in Somalia, in Afghanistan, and other places, all of those grievances and the hyper-local conflicts are enabling these groups to expand. and it's there that we must be focus our foreign policy efforts.
But somebody listening might say, well, I'm going to throw my hands up, because these are long simmering cultural divides between different sects within the Arab world and the Muslim faith. We've seen the Arab Spring. I don't know what happened to that. It dissipated on us. We have all these autocracies, and we've got these kingdoms like Saudi Arabia that seem to act in very curious ways. So what is America to do?
I think the first thing is to turn to our partners and actually lead them. So when we're looking at what's happening in the world, we're not going at this alone. There are local partners, there are regional partners, there are Western partners, all of whom are affected by the developments on the ground and all of whom are trying to do their own thing. But there isn't a kind of global strategy that everyone's locking into. I think that's a critical component that has been missing that the United States can and should be providing. You know, the second thing is to recognize that, yes, while it may seem like these conflicts are never-ending and something persistent and weren't in place, a lot of them are actually different today. And there are local forms of governance that have persisted over hundreds of years, and these have broken down, and it's re-empowering the systems that were in place that will add resilience to these communities to enable them to prevent the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda or other groups from exploiting them.
I think it was the president himself who recently, in talking about the Saudis and the Khashoggi murder, said, well, there are no good guys. I mean, who are we supposed to side with here? And I think there are a lot of Americans who think that way as well. You say that there are these groups forming, and we can figure out. I mean, I remember when President Obama said, well, we're going to arm some of the moderates in Syria. And then there was a later report that there were five moderates that we spent millions of dollars on. So help us to understand, you know, again, because I don't think we want to be naive about this, but we also don't want to be overly expectant that we have reliable partners on the ground just ready to join with America.
The thing that gets missed is that the ideology, the beliefs that Al-Qaeda hold and that the Islamic State holds are as abhorrent to other Muslims as they are to Americans. They are the Islam that these groups say is legitimate is incredibly fringe in terms of its ideas, and there is a natural resistance to it. The challenge is many of the communities, they're not focusing on resisting these groups because they're sensing other threats, whether it's a conflict that has sprung up or the fact that they need water or other forms of services that the groups provide, and they don't feel enabled to push the groups away. So in a sense, what we need to do is take this competitive nature that the United States has and help to facilitate it at that local level in order to outcompete the very bad services that these groups are able to deliver.
Is there a country right now in the Middle East ready for this kind of intervention in a way where we could actually see some modest or substantial results?
I think that when you're looking at it, you can say that Iraq would be a good place to start. There is a healthy state institution to work through, and the country just needs to go through kind of a period of reconciliation, which it hasn't. The problem is with our strategy for defeating the Islamic State, it was entirely predicated, as you noted, on removing the terrain, and very little was focused on the political outcome or how we took away that terrain, such that we left it now to some groups that have Iranian backing and support and that are actually driving additional conflict inside of the country. There are other examples as well, but it's also going to take a mindset change from Americans and particularly from our congressmen in terms of taking risk to whether we start a program and it doesn't succeed. This is a new type of engagement, and so we need to try new things.
You say that our strategy largely ignores the fact that the movement seeks to replace the governance systems of the Muslim majority world, not primarily to attack America or Europe. And yet, just, I'd say, 2 to 3 years back, they had us all on edge, particularly with the attacks in Europe. And you say that's not necessarily what they're intending to do, and yet they could revive that effort. You say the movement does not currently prioritize attacks on American soil, but this could change.
It could. And this goes back to the beginning of our conversation, where we're talking about the fact that threats to the homeland have been going down, which is great. Except when you think about how many trained operatives were out in the field on 9/11, it was in the hundreds. And today, we can have a conservative estimate that there are thousands of individuals with those capabilities. And so you can kind of start to think about, what if they start to operationalize and plan attacks back here? We are at much greater risk for an attack than we were in 2001. The point about their decision, though, is, you know, they actually do want to focus on the Muslim world, and it's American interventionism, their words, that they've been trying to push back on. And so as the United States as a nation adopts a sense of isolationism, we're allowing them to achieve some of their own objectives.
When you look at where we are coming down in the Middle East today, generally on the side of the Sunnis, like the Saudis, who actually are working with Israel to some extent against Iran, help us understand that axis of the Arab conflict today in a large sense between Iran and, say, Saudi Arabia, and where your concerns might fit into that overarching dichotomy, if you will, between the Sunnis and the Shia.
The Iranian-Saudi axis is one that's always been over hegemony of the region, and it's not actually over religion. But increasingly what's happened is, as Iran has strengthened, it is strengthening religious groups that are pushing back on the average Sunni community. And so what we're seeing is the overall radicalization of both sides. And Saudi Arabia's response has been to, of course, mobilize its networks, which run through Salafi channels and run through more radical groups. So the real challenge for the United States is ensuring that the Saudi Arabian-Iranian proxy war doesn't actually turn into a full-blown sectarian war in the region, because that actually enables these groups to strengthen.
Is that likely, given some of the concerns I know that many in the Senate have about our policy relating to Yemen and siding with the Saudis there?
It's likely that we'll prevent an actual sectarian war. I think the challenges come in misunderstanding the Saudi role inside of Yemen and the Iranian role inside of Yemen, and trying to achieve certain effects against Saudi Arabia by affecting the Yemeni civil war.
Is there anything else that we have not discussed today that you think is very relevant to this conversation about American strategy? I think a lot of people would wonder how different, because the Trump administration's view of a lot of things certainly differs from its predecessors. Are we much different today, or are we basically on the same course that we have been with previous administrations?
I think anyone from the administration would argue that it's a different course, though experts from the outside would say it's been the same course that we've seen from the Bush administration through the Obama administration and now through the Trump administration. I think one of the places that always gets forgotten about is Africa and the contest that's happening there, because it's never high up on U.S. priorities, but it's a space really where a little bit of investment from the United States could go a long way in terms of resolving some of the threats that are coming down the pipeline.
Well, the full report is called Terrorism, Tactics, and Transformation: The West versus the Salafi Jihadi Movement, and you can get it at aei.org. Catherine Zimmerman has been with us today. She's a research fellow in the area of terrorism, and I want to thank you for joining us here and updating us on what is going on in the Middle East and our response to it here on America Trends.
Super. Thank you so much.